In fact, I had three interesting guests in the studio for Tuesday's program, in which we talked about the current theatrical production on stage at Carthage College, one of the world's most ancient and significant plays, Antigone, by Sophocles. Joining me in the studio was Herschel Kruger, professor of theater at Carthage, his wife, Maureen Chavez Kruger, who was the set designer for this production, and Kim Instanis, who designed the costumes. Although it is an ancient play, which had its very first performance right around the year 440 BC, the choice was made to update this play in this production into a post-apocalyptic world. We talked about how that decision was ultimately made. So, Herschel Kruger, you were saying that once you had chosen a translation, what you were anticipating was very likely a fairly straight-ahead, straightforward kind of treatment of this old classic. And apparently there were other people who had other ideas.
Yeah, I was really thinking about it, and I keep teasing them that there was collusion between the two, that they wanted to do this modern version or maybe even this futuristic version. And I don't know what had clicked. You know, Maureen had like shared some things with me, and Kim had shown me, look what my class was working on, and we said Antigone in the future. And I don't know, one day I just said Mad Max, Antigone, Mad Max. So, I mean, it wasn't hard to imagine what's happening with climate change and our most precious resource of water and what could come of that and where we might end up in 250 or 300 years. So, you know, we decided, and what I wrote was there's 50 years of water wars, and 250 years after that are, you know, the vestiges of our industrial and technological world are, you know, few and far between, and we're almost back in this ancient civilization. And, you know, we just took it from there. It's an imaginary place to start, and it gave us a lot of freedom to be creative about the world that the play would take place in. So we still had all different classical elements, both in the set and what inspired the set, and also in costumes, in the way they were draped, the colors and materials that we used, and then also imagined what this world would be like at this point. So that gave us a lot of freedom to be creative and artistic, and I think it's produced a really, you know, magical production, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and both of their promptings have been very helpful for putting this play together.
Very good. So I am curious to hear from each of you, first of all, if there was any collusion, any conversations, whatever you want to call it, or did each of you kind of independent of the other start wondering about the possibility of taking this ancient play and setting it into the future?
I think we did have one conversation, remember? I was showing you some things from actually 9/11, kind of those images that I had, and that's what kind of started, you know, that's what started me about it. But it was a small conversation that we had, but we both kind of were going in that direction, and but really wanted to retain like a foundation of that we are in Greece, but we're just in the future in Greece, and what would that look like? One main inspiration for me for the set itself, and if you go when you go to the show, it's the footprint of it is actually a burial ancient burial ground that was just actually excavated. Like, I just found an article before we started working on the productions, but that was revealed. So I started doing some research onto that, because the whole issue of burying, or the honor of burying, you know, her brother, Antigone's brother, is a big part of the show. So that. So I thought if we could start there, that would be an interesting place to be. And then with that, tying in some things with water insecurity, and I don't want to give away too much, but you know, there's some really beautiful, like Herschel said, really beautiful classical elements that are still retaining there, and still are retained and preserved. But there's a little contemporary images and things that are put in there. And one thing I just wanted to say really quick was that I think what's really unique about the show is. And not something that we haven't done before, but something that I really love is bypassing the traditional seating of the theater and placing the set in the round, you know, placing it on the stage with your audience around it in full circle, which I think really helps, especially for this play, because you can get lost in the translation or the words and all of that. But when the actors are right in front of you and around you and walking by you and all of that, you can't help but be engaged in what they're talking about, you know. So I think that for our viewers or whatever, that would be a really unique experience, because we don't always get a chance to see theater in the round, and it is definitely a wonderful challenge for director, costume designer, lighting designer, sound designer, everybody. So that's kind of a fun aspect of the show.
So you end up with a really immersive experience as an audience member. Very good. How about you, Kim? Do you remember what prompted you to start thinking about this play being set in the future?
Well, I love this play. I always put it on in the voting box, right, for every year. It was like, we could do this play. But I also, and I teach costume design, and I was teaching that in the spring when we started talking about the show. And in costume design, I decided to use Antigone because we were going to do it the next season. It's always nice to tie in, you know, the things we're going to be doing into my classes. And so as a project, we take one play and we do it in the period, we do it modern dress, and then I always have them do it post-apocalyptic, because it gives them an opportunity to sort of stretch those design stylization skills. And so we were doing that in my class when Herschel came to visit our class, and so it kind of, it was, I guess I wasn't originally thinking we would do it post-apocalyptic, but it was kind of cool the way that some of the projects were turning out. And actually one of the students did do a sort of water version of it where they were all wearing scuba suits and things. So that one was fun. So I think that's where that came from with us, is with the costumes. And then, you know, we just, again, I used the ancient Greek research, but then we sort of translated into, you know, I made a list of what would be the things that these people would have to have. You know, they'd have to have a weapon of some kind. They'd have to have a place to put their water bottle. They'd have to have clothing that was both cooling and covering, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody has a headscarf and everybody has gloves, but fingerless gloves, so it's not too hot. Like that's where we started with what's this going to look like in a post-apocalyptic world.
Mm. Sounds fascinating. So Herschel, explain what the kind of the way in which authority gets shared and decisions get made. I mean, ultimately, is this all up to you? Or, I mean, does Kim Instanis have the right to do any crazy thing she comes up with, or some combination of the two? I mean, ultimately, how do you arrive at the final product in terms of what this production ultimately looks like, how it takes shape?
Yeah, I think ultimately everyone has the freedom to work. Once we start defining our world and understanding our space and the people in it and how they dress and everything, there's a ton of freedom, I think, for that. But I think understanding what the play is still about is the most important. And why is Antigone still such an inspiring character and story after 2,500 years really became the most important part of my work. So we had that creative freedom, and I've worked with Maureen and Kim on lots of productions. So I trust their artistry, and I knew whatever we came up with, already seeing what the directions would be in initial renderings. but it kept coming back to, we have to tell this story. And why is Antigone so inspiring?
That was Herschel Kruger, stage director for Carthage College's production of Antigone by Sophocles. Also on Tuesday's morning show, Maureen Chavez Kruger, set designer for the production, and Kim Instanis, designer of the costumes for Antigone. By the way, the final performance of Antigone is tonight at Wartburg Auditorium on the campus of Carthage College. You're listening to Morning Show Saturday on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I also had the great pleasure this past week of connecting with a very fine concert pianist by the name of Joanne Polk, who is coming to the campus of Carthage College to play a recital Tuesday evening, a concert which will be comprised entirely of music by great women composers. This has been one of the predominant themes of Joanne Polk's distinguished career. By the way, Joanne Polk is on the piano faculty at Manhattan School of Music, one of the finest music conservatories in the country. I had a conversation via telephone in which I learned a great deal about Joanne Polk and her life as a musician and pianist. I know from what I have read about your life and career that you demonstrated at a remarkably early age some exceptional musical gifts. Tell us what your parents sort of witnessed you doing at a very, very young age and what that prompted them to do.
I think I was two, and there was a piano in the house, and my older sister at the time was studying piano, and I just climbed up on the bench and started playing the pieces that she was studying, and just played a lot by ear, and I think they just got very excited, and they took me to Juilliard when I was four. And I even remember that audition. I was a little young for Juilliard, so I got to wait 3 whole years and then went back when I was 7. And then I was in the Juilliard pre-college starting from the age of 7, but I started studying the piano when I was 4. And I think they were just, my parents were just very excited because my ear, you know, and I think you're just born with this kind of gift, although it's up to us then to develop it. But I think they were just very excited to see this kind of passion in someone so young.
Right. Did that talent sort of come out of nowhere, or were either of them musicians themselves?
They were not musicians themselves. As a matter of fact, my father was Lee Polk. He was a children's television producer, and when I was little, he did Romper Room, and I remember going on Romper Room. And many of the children's shows, he worked for the public TV station. But I think they loved music. I had an aunt who wrote the song Three Little Fishies. And so there was music in the family, and I had a cousin who was a violist who ended up in the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, but not really, and he was the only one who was another professional musician. But no, there wasn't a professional musician. I think there was just a love of music. So I don't know whether or not it came out of nowhere. I think it sort of evolved from generation to generation. And my son is a cellist, so it's different there, but... Yeah, I think there was just a lot of excitement, but not being musicians, I think they made interesting decisions about who I was going to study with as a kid, and it's different. I think when you're in the business, I think you can make a little bit more informed decisions. So it was a little rough for a while to find the right teachers, but eventually it happened.
Well, and of course things have evolved very, very well, and of course one does not. Hear every day about someone who was 7 years old studying at Juilliard. And I think I have heard you say in interviews that Juilliard no longer teaches children who are quite that young, but you don't seem to have been harmed in any way. And indeed, you've gone on to this great career.
Yeah. I don't speak from complete authority. I don't know, but I believe that they're not taking kids that young, and I actually think that's a good choice. I think it's a little young to be, because you're in school 5 days a week, and then you're at Juilliard pre-college for a sixth day, and I think that's a choice better made a little bit later in a child's life. And it's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to surround yourself with music on a Saturday. But I think it's just a little bit young at that point. Mm.
Was it always sort of a foregone conclusion that you were going to give yourself over to the piano in the way that you have, or at certain points where there are other things that weighed in as very real alternatives to that?
That's a wonderful question. I've never been asked that. I think it was a foregone conclusion in everybody's mind, and probably including my own, that I was going to remain a pianist. I had a great passion from my teenage years for psychology, and at one point thought of double majoring. As when I was graduating from high school, I wanted to double major in psychology and piano, but just it just didn't resonate. I mean, it's still a great passion of mine. I've been studying psychology for decades, but as a profession, I don't know, there was something, I always felt like I heard something in music that I needed to communicate. And I think it was a foregone conclusion in my parents' mind and in my teacher's mind. I know I had some other ideas, but I don't think there was ever going to be another profession, just other passions.
Right. How do you see the two aspects of your professional life, that is, of being an active concert pianist, a performer, but also as a teacher? I mean, are they, in a sense, perfectly melded in your mind in terms of one feeding into the other, or do they feel more like sort of distinct pursuits, obviously closely related, but also really, really different from each other?
Oh, no, they're very closely related. I learn a lot from my students, and I learn a lot from teaching my students. I've discovered subtleties and pieces from teaching my students, from working with students from all over the world. So I find them very closely related. I've watched students grow. I've watched students blossom. I've watched students leave the business, you know, decide it's not for them, which I think is as important as deciding that it is for them. I've also watched myself grow, not only as a pedagogue, but as a pianist through the teaching. So I think they're very much aligned.
Mm. I wonder if you would say a word about the renowned Manhattan School of Music, where you have studied and where you now are on the piano faculty. And I want to add parenthetically, also on the piano faculty there is a former music colleague of mine at Carthage, Dr. Y.L. Farouk. Tell us more about the Manhattan School of Music and the kind of education that it seeks to deliver to its students.
Oh, that's another wonderful question, and we're so glad that Dr. Farouk has joined us. He's such a just an enriching addition to the faculty. When I got bachelor's and master's at Juilliard and took a bit of time off when I graduated with my master's to perform and enter competitions, and I took 9 years off and then decided that I needed more education. I just needed more information, especially when it came to performing contemporary pieces. I just didn't feel like I knew enough to give living composers a voice. And I heard about the Manhattan School of Music and went back as a doctoral student. And really, that was where I really found a lot of my voices from the Manhattan School of Music. I found the environment very warm and embracing. I found the teachers very stimulating. And right now, the Manhattan School of Music is very involved in a cultural inclusion initiative. And we're exploring all kinds of new repertoire by underrepresented composers. So I think there's a sort of a general outlook of not only inclusion, but embracing all kinds of cultures, all kinds of music, that I find supports really everybody's interest. Really, I mean, even people who simply just want to play Chopin, it even supports people who want to focus in on one composer who's historical. But the environment there is forward-looking. And how do we continue to make classical music relevant in a society that is changing and evolving? And sometimes classical music can almost feel like a museum at times. How do you make it relevant? How do you keep it interesting, not only to concertgoers, but to young people? It's something that the school is constantly exploring and discussing and having seminars about. So, and encouraging the students to, but this year, I think for the first time, we have a gospel choir, and that's just wonderful for the students. So it's ever evolving and a wonderful place to be.
Joanne Polk is on the piano faculty at the Manhattan School of Music, and she is coming to the campus of Carthage College to play a recital this Tuesday evening, October 11th at 7:30 p.m., a concert program which will consist entirely of music by great female composers, including Amy Beach, Cécile Chaminade, and Louise Farrenc. Tickets will be available at the door, and you can also get more information by going to carthage.edu. You're listening to Morning Show Saturday. I'm Gregory Berg. I also had the great pleasure this past week of speaking via telephone with Dr. Jason Karlowish, who is on the faculty at the medical school at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Karlowish is one of the country's most renowned experts when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, and he has written a book about it called The Problem of Alzheimer's. That is also the title of the presentation with which Dr. Karlowish will be delivering at the University of Wisconsin Parkside this coming Wednesday morning, October 12th, 9 to 11, in the Student Center Cinema. Here is a portion of the conversation which I was able to record with Dr. Karlowish.
Yeah, the story actually goes back to the early 20th century, 1905, 6, 7, 8, 9. Over 100 years ago, medical science was making pretty impressive progress with understanding, uncovering the mysteries, because what they were doing was saying, there's something about these older adults who we think have senility, an extreme stage of aging for which there's nothing you can do about it and no disease involved, and saying, well, it doesn't seem to be the case. And I really sort of enjoyed and chronicled this in the book, The Problem of Alzheimer's, how these scientists were making spectacular progress. And then it all stopped, and it all stopped because it was taking place in Germany. And, you know, I mentioned those years deliberately because I think anyone who's familiar with world history, particularly European history, will know that after about 1914, things got really bad in Germany. And I talk about that and the aftermath of it, which kind of led to a dark ages, quite literally, for much of the 20th century until the story picks up again, but this time across the Atlantic Ocean in the United States of America. And so, you know, that's why the subtitle of the book is How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis, because it is really a story much more than just simply there are a lot of old people, which is one of the reasons why there are a lot of people with Alzheimer's. But the reason why this disease went from being rare to a crisis are because of these cultural and political events that I talk about. And they begin, as I say, in the early 20th century, and it's very much about a story of Germany in the early 20th century.
Right. So I think what you're saying is it was not because of any specific reason or for any purpose that attention was diverted from this. It was just due to the chaos that engulfed Germany and so much of Europe with the First World War and events after that, and then the Second World War. I mean, that in a sense, all kinds of things, including this, were shoved to the side. I mean, is that the essence of it?
I mean, yeah, because what happened in Germany was that was where the progress was being made in some very elegant neuropathology work using like light microscopy, you know, as opposed to electron microscopy. And they were really beginning to make some great progress, but then, you know, it wasn't just the war and the economic problems. It was also the political and cultural transformations in Germany, namely the rise of eugenics and euthanasia theories, as instantiated, of course, through the National Socialist ideology of the Nazis, that all worked together, not just simply to, you know, create economic chaos to limit the ability to do the research, but also created a cultural milieu that really sank progress in psychiatric neuropathologic approaches to these diseases, and instead embraced this kind of dark eugenic view, and it ruined the science, it ruined the reputations of the scientists, et cetera. And then, of course, what happened was biologic psychiatry, as it was being practiced then, faded away, and Freudianism took over. And there's an interesting story about how Freudianism went from being this fringe approach to thinking about mental illness, brain illness, to being a dominant approach. And, of course, America was the ground zero of Freudian practice in psychiatry, which, of course, is amusing because Freud hated America. He was a bit of a snob. And of course, it's amusing that, of course, America just embraced Freudianism. And so it crowded out, thinking about diseases of the brain as being caused by any kind of biology, but rather, you know, instead embraced a Freudian idea of, you know, suppressed psychopathologies.
Wow. So there are these forces that, in effect, are diverting attention, suppressing study, and that really is tragic when one thinks about promising breakthroughs so early on that came to nothing because of that.
If World War One hadn't happened, and the work of Alois Alzheimer's, Oscar Fischer, Prusini, and others was allowed to continue apace, it's quite possible by 1960 that there would have been this recognition that older adults who were being sort of dismissed as senile, you know, extreme aging, nothing you can do about it, that would have been, no, there's a disease going on here. And it really raises interesting possibilities about where we'd be now. And I think it would have a lot of influence on improving our overall well-being, because we would have earlier on seen that, you know, these older adults who are losing their ability to self-determine their lives, families being swept up in kind of a maelstrom of all kinds of problems, you know, that we really need to support them and support the autonomy of these older adults and their children, adult children, spouses, et cetera. But none of that happened, and I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, frankly, anti-liberal attitudes sort of, you know, linger and still linger. Because, you know, if you see things like losing your ability to live your life the way you want to as just part of nature, you know, you just think, well, there's nothing we can do about it, and et cetera. And we could have made much more progress, but that didn't happen.
Hmm. My understanding is that that there was something of a scientific reawakening, or maybe an awakening for the first time in certain places to the significance of Alzheimer's. Ahead of us talking about that, early on, as you said, it's Dr. Alois Alzheimer in Germany who first puts a name to this disorder. At that point in time, would any medical doctors in the United States of America, for instance, have heard of Alzheimer's? Was it known at all?
Absolutely not. The disease was put into one of the editions in the late 19-teens of Emil Kreplin's psychiatry textbook. He mentions Alzheimer's disease as a cause of the senile dementias, and notably, by the way, not the early onset. If you read the book, that point will certainly shock you. So it was in his textbook, but it never caught hold. In part because Kreplin's textbook faded from existence, because Kreplin got swept up in Nazism, and his textbook became just not read. And so in America, the idea of diagnosing Alzheimer's disease was just, the physician was looking at, what are you talking about? I don't even know what that is. I think it's a very important point, actually, because by about the late 19-teens, even into the 1920s, in Munich, a historian, Lara Koik, historian of medicine, currently working out of Berlin, she's going through the archives of the Munich Hospital, and the physicians there were actually diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. If you go to the medical records, you see them recording, you know, Alzheimer's disease as the cause of someone's dementia, and both young and old people, that is to say people in their 50s and people in their 70s or 80s. And so they were using this diagnosis. Of course, that all sort of faded as well, because, again, yeah, things really just after about the 1920s fell apart in Germany.
Dr. Jason Karlowish speaks Wednesday morning, 9 a.m., at the UW Parkside Student Center Cinema. It's a free presentation. To register to attend, go to uwp.edu/HHS. And look for the morning show archive on our website, wgtd.org. I'm Gregory Berg. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Well, this week on WGTD's Noon Tunes, we're featuring the music of Rebecca and the Gray Notes from Milwaukee. At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist. So please join us for Noon Tunes, Monday through Friday, 12:20 p.m., here on WGTD HD.